Welcome to Censored. I'm Aoife Vritnach, a historian reading novels for filth so you don't have to. Though I think you should read some of them, but probably not for the smut, maybe the literary merit or the laughs. If you'd like to support the show, there are links in the show notes to Patreon and the web shop. Buy a sticker or maybe leave a review, anything at all. At last, I have finally gotten round to Sean O'Fualloin, one of the giants of mid-20th century Irish literature. His novel, Bird Alone, was published in 1936 and banned that same year. This experience provoked years of anti-censorship work. He wrote essays, founded a radical journal, and protested against censorship as loudly as possible. He was a public intellectual in a state that used the censorship legislation to target writers like him. By any measure, he was a big deal in Irish cultural life. It was particularly galling for the establishment to be criticised by a man with O'Fualloin's impeccable nationalist credentials. He had fought in the War of Independence and later on the Republican side in the Civil War. He was also a Catholic who never disavowed Catholicism. All of his critiques were those of an insider, so he couldn't be easily dismissed. He didn't even disagree with censorship in principle, just the extreme version that Ireland produced. But I wanted to actually read his work and learn more about that rather than focus on his activism. So I chose his second novel, Bird Alone. It's set in his home place, Cork City, and is written from the point of view of Corny Crone, a young man embarking on a great love affair. So this is the blurb from the back of the book. With the anti-clericalism of his Fenian forebears strong in his veins, Corny Crone sets out to destroy the holiness enveloping the girl he loves. That does not sound great. Bit odd. But the rest of the blurb doesn't get any better. It says, "This book's society choice, from a master storyteller, contains all that is Ireland. The humour, the passion, the contradiction." God, sounds awful. But my commitment to the podcast is such that I got over my revulsion at that paddywhackery and read the book anyway. I also persuaded a guest to talk to me. I am joined by Dr. Paul Delaney from Trinity College Dublin. Paul has written about Bird Alone in his 2014 study called Sean O'Fualloin, Literature, Inheritance and the 1930s. He's also written about William Trevor and Colm Tobin, but they've not been banned in Ireland, so he's joining me to talk about Sean O'Fualloin this time. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Aoife. How are you? It's great to be here today.
Yes, it's good. It's very good to talk about Sean O'Fualloin. He's one of those people that I've always known existed, but strangely enough, I don't read him very often.
It's hard to be honest, Aoife, partly because he's almost entirely out of print. It's astonishing. O'Fualloin was in his day one of the most important, most influential Irish writers. He lived a very long life. He lived for the best part of the 20th century. He died when he was in his early 90s. But today, for quite some time, he's been almost entirely out of print. So it's something which is beginning to change again. And maybe it's to do with the vagaries of publishing and so on. But I think you're probably in the majority, you know, I think actually at the moment.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, of course, like I know his name. He's just everywhere in, you know, modern literary system. And in Cork. Hello.
Yes. Indeed.
Although, you know, we have murals in this city of Irish writers and they don't have Sean O'Fualloin or Frank O'Connor in them.
Yeah. I don't know if I should share you. I was just in advance today. He said something funny about Cork. I don't know if I should say this. Do you know what he said about being in Cork?
What?
Did you know this? He talked about how Cork wasn't a place for sensitive people. I don't know if you if you know that. He said in order to succeed in Cork, he says you have to have the skin of a rhinoceros, the dissimulation of a crocodile, the quality of a hare, and the speed of a hawk, he said. Otherwise, the word for every Cork man, and indeed Cork woman, is to get out and get out quick. There might be a reason why he's not on murals in Cork.
Yeah, he just offended everybody.
Yeah, I think he did.
So today we're talking about Bird Alone, which was published in 1936 and banned the same year. They didn't let the grass grow under their feet on that one. you know, the way I try and figure out why, if they actually read it, why it was banned. And I thought, for me, the first part was on page 37.
Yeah.
The main character, Corny, who's Cornelius, of course, he's speaking to his grandfather, who he calls his grander. And he is, his grandfather is giving out stink about his own brother who ran away with an actress, I think.
That's right, yeah.
It's got some interesting undercurrents where Grander may, in fact, have fancied the actress rotten and his brother got in before him. And so he's given out stink and he's complaining and he decides to quote Shakespeare. And it's written, "Then in a mean whining voice like a cor-cor, he snivelled, 'My lord, I have remembrances of yours that I've longed long to deliver. I pray you now receive them.'" Now, I'm not going to put on a Cork accent for that because that's just too weird. But I suppose, first of all, saying the word whore might be a bridge too far. Cor-cor, like an Irish one. And then making Ophelia into a whore. I mean, he's doing three bad things there. So that was my thought.
No, I think you're. I think it's fair. I think that, do you know, I think there are a number of reasons why this book was banned more generally, if I could. And I think that one of the is that kind of subtext of sex, which is writ through this book. That, you know, there's actually quite a lot about the body in this book. And this is something that O'Fuelon as a writer was hugely interested in, really genuinely interested in, and thought that it was time for Irish writers to seriously represent it. And he felt that some writers had, but in the main, Irish writing had not. In addition, I suppose, there was a simple thing, and that was that by the time this book was published, this was the second of O'Fuelon's books to be banned. The previous was his first short story collection, Midsummer Night Madness and Other Stories, which was set against the backdrop largely of the Irish War of Independence and Civil War. And that was banned for a couple of reasons, and especially because of a short story called The Small Lady, in which a woman who has informed on the IRA and to the Crown forces is captured by the IRA and is executed the following morning. And just before her execution, the night before her execution, she makes love to one of the soldiers, and the book was banned because of that story. O'Fuelon, in the interim between 1932 and 1936, really campaigns very, very heavily against censorship. He is really angry about the banning of Midsummer Night Madness. And he's also very, very, very angry about the more general extension of the use of censorship in Ireland since its introduction in the late 1920s. And he really begins to become very, very, very incensed about the use of censorship in Ireland. And he becomes so public about it and so critical that there is an argument that I think there's a guy, Peter Martin, who's written a wonderful history of censorship in this stage. But he suggests that actually this book was largely banned because directly of clerical interference, and that this was banned because O'Fuelon had basically criticised the church in Ireland to such an extent that this was their, if you will, their response, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That he was, if you like, he was almost a marked man by the time this book comes out. And as you say, then he begins with the references to a Cork whore. And he plays up, doesn't he, that kind of historic association between actresses, and prostitution. And that's in the background of that story, isn't it, in relation to Cork. I don't know if that would make sense to you as well. I think that it's partly because of sex, for definite. And this becomes more important as the novel proceeds. I don't know about you, but one of the reasons I think the book was banned as well was quite simply was because of the way it engages with the relationship between Corny and Elsie.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's courting, but with sex. So,
oh, yeah, absolutely. It is, isn't it? It is very, very explicit in this book that Corny and Elsie are lovers. And in a sense, O'Fuelon draws on that kind of classic trope of star-crossed lovers, you know, a young couple whom are being drawn together, but their fates are being pulled apart by their parents and by the church and all of this kind of stuff going on. But their attraction is so great that it ends up in this book with them having sex outside of marriage. And indeed, Elsie gets pregnant. And then what's more, Elsie tries to, there are ideations of, and she tries to commit suicide. And it's like, my God, you know, I think if the church were gunning for O'Fuaylon, he gave them a lot of ammunition with this book, you know, that there's a lot of good, there's a lot of reason insofar as there was any reason to ban. And that this book was, as you say, very quickly banned.
So that's interesting, because I was wondering, was he singled out for personal attention by the censors, because he was such a pain in the ass about it, you know. He didn't shut up. He talked about it all the time. He never stopped criticizing it. A lot of authors, I mean, they just kind of, you know, it was just an occupational hazard, but he never laid down and took it. And I was wondering whether that book was part of singling him out in that way.
I think it was. I think it was. And I think if anything, then it only just consolidates his hatred of censorship in Ireland, that it leads to some very specific things. For instance, one of the things it leads to is a very important early essay of his, which was published in the radical journal Ireland Today, kind of a short-lived journal in Ireland in the late 1930s. In 1936, the same year as the banning of Bird Alone, O'Fuaylon writes an essay called The Dangers of Censorship. And it's published in Ireland Today. And it's partly occasioned by the banning of Bird Alone, but also by the banning of two other books at the same time by Irish writers, Francis Hackett and Francis Hackett's novel, The Green Line. And The Green Line, I don't know, is one of these novels which have long since fallen out of print. But The Green Line basically is the story of the illegitimate child of a seminarian, which you can imagine was always court controversy. And the other was Austin Clark, the poet Austin Clark, who wrote a novel called The Singing Men at Cashel. And basically, Clark writes a romance of religious orthodoxy and of personal freedom, of a clash between religious orthodoxy and personal freedom in medieval Ireland. And he uses kind of medieval Ireland as a way to talk about the contemporary. He uses it, you know, as a lens through which to talk about it. He displaces it. Each of these books are banned. O'Fuaylon knows Francis Hackett very well. He's friends with him. He knows Clark as well. And he is incensed by the banning of those two books along with his own. And he writes this really important essay called The Dangers of Censorship. And it isn't the first, but it's one of the earliest really, truly significant anti-censorship texts that O'Fuaylon writes, which he'll continue then to do for the next 30 years. So yeah, you're right. He will be a pain in the ass right the way up to the point when he's editing The Bell in the 1940s, is involved in civil liberty movements in the 1950s. And indeed, in the mid-60s, he gives a very, very, very interesting short kind of cameo appearance on Peter Lennon's very controversial, was it banned? I'm not quite sure. Unofficially banned, perhaps, film The Rocky Road to Dublin, in which O'Fuaylon is just caustic about the state of Ireland and he excoriates the church and the state. So he really is. He's really angry with the banning of this book.
It is quite a sensitive text. I mean, he isn't being provocative in a, you know, a kind of an ugly or a coarse way. He is trying to explore ideas around sex and also, I suppose, growing up. In some ways, it's a novel about growing up. Corney and Elsie are incredibly young and they have to grow up through their courtship and through what happens to them and to their bodies. So it is trying to be an intelligent book. You know, it isn't a test case in the sense of provocative.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I'd agree entirely, Aoife. I think that he's not writing a sensationalist text. You know, that the sex, which is here, pardon me, in this text, isn't front and centre. It's not there for the sake of it. It's rather because we have two young people who really do fancy each other, you know, and they actually try not to, you know. And I think that's one of the important things too, especially Elsie.
Oh, yeah, very much so. She's kind of persuaded into it at the very beginning, isn't she?
She is. And I think one of the things which is quite interesting with this book is, you know, like on the one hand, it seems to me what O'Faylon does is he draws on kind of classic models. There are texts that he's looking to as kind of as archetypes. You know, there's a lot about Faust in this story, and the Faustian myths is here very strong. There's a lot of references to Shakespeare, as you mentioned yourself. There's a lot, and especially to Hamlet and Ophelia. And that's one of the key texts that O'Faylon is utilising in this. So you have this sense again of a young couple being drawn together, very young couple being drawn together, being pulled apart, and trying to trust themselves and one another. And in Elsie's case especially, I suppose, because she is very, there's a very strong sense that she's a very strongly practising Catholic, that this is against everything she believes. And O'Faylon is very, very interested in that tension, in that struggle between, if you like, almost between your body and between the mind, or, you know, in that kind of way, if you
morals and faith kind of mind.
Absolutely. So that when, if you remember late in the text, when Elsie is, when she's near death, and she's terrified not of death, and she's terrified not because of the child that she has lost, the unborn child, but she's terrified because of the sin that she committed, as she sees with them, Corny, and that becomes a real kind of moral fulcrum for the text. That sense of genuine fear of sin, and consequently of her dying without being relieved of that sin, without any sense of penance or any sense of absolution. And O'Faylon is very interested in that. Now, you know, I don't think he fully believes it, but he's very interested in that. And that sense of the absolute terror of someone like Elsie at that point, which is real. I think it's very, very telling that, you know, Elsie dies without a priest coming in time to give her
rites. Terrible. But
it was really cruel.
Yeah, it was really cruel.
It's so unfair.
I mean, in Catholicism, to die without the last rites from the priest is pretty serious. It's nearly the worst thing that can happen to you. So it was horrendous.
Yeah, and if you think, like, so this is in a text of the 1930s, so it's even worse. But then, like, he's actually imaginatively projecting further back and into the 1890s. So it's so long ago that for her to do this, for this to have to happen, with this weight of a sin on her, is really, really important.
When they first have sex, it's kind of on the hill overlooking the Lee Fields, I think, from the way they're describing it. And he's, you know, he's obviously asking or pressuring in some way. And she says what I thought was the weirdest thing. She says, "But all Cork and the nuns in their little beds." What? I mean, so this sexual relationship is to be visible to the whole city, but particularly the nuns.
In their little beds.
You know, and I thought it was an interesting way of how people would articulate their understanding of transgressive sex, that it was a hugely public act, even if it's in the middle of nowhere, in a forest. It's actually, like, people will know on some level that you have committed a sin or broken the rules or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, like, on the one hand, I think one way of I think reading that scene and quite a number of scenes in this novel is just to think, oh my God, O'Faylon can be really cringy when he writes, you know, he can get it so wrong. And in fairness, sometimes I think that is absolutely true. Do you know what? I think that's an instance of it. I think as someone who's, you know, I've read a good bit of O'Faylon now at this stage, I don't think he always writes women very well. I think actually he often writes women very badly. There are some instances maybe in some of his shorter fiction where, you know, it's not quite the same. But I think in this novel, for sure. I think as well, though, I think that sense of people struggling to articulate, like, I'd agree with you, Yvonne, that completely. There is this sense in which, again, I think it's in his autobiography. He's very angry when he thinks back to the world that he grew up in and the kind of education he got. O'Faylon was very well educated. Like he went through the secondary school at a time when relatively few people, you know, in Ireland would have gone through secondary school. He went to UCC. He was awarded a scholarship to study in the United States to do further postgraduate work. He was very, very, very well educated for his time and class. But he felt that as a child growing up, that one of the things that Ireland didn't do was teach young boys and men, sorry, young boys and young girls about their bodies and about sexuality. And he talked about, in his terms, in his words, he talked about throwing, talked about the young people being thrown out, he said, naked to the wolves of life. And like it has a hugely contemporary resonance still.
Oh, hugely. I mean, it's remained an issue in Ireland up until probably extremely recently.
Yeah. And like it is something that he detects certainly in the early 60s. And he's like he's articulating it then, but he's thinking about it much earlier than that. And that sense that for someone like Elsie, how does she articulate her fear? How does she articulate? And that might be a slightly kinder way of excusing him for the cringiness of what it is that Elsie actually says. Maybe we're looking for something here, but I don't think it's entirely that. I think that there is the sense, certainly, that Elsie can't articulate her desire. And she struggles to reconcile that desire with the faith that she genuinely has and believes in. And that is something that remains very difficult for her.
I thought it was hilarious as well, that particular line. I mean, it just stuck with me, but that anyone, I mean, that it's so Cork. I mean, the insistence, the foregrounding of Cork throughout the book, he constantly talks about like someone's accent being this type of Cork accent or the other type of Cork accent. And I sometimes wondered, you know, how was it received in the sense of, did people feel that this was an overly restrictive setting that he placed it in, that he rooted it so strongly in Cork? Did they feel like they missed things, or was that considered an interesting aspect of the text?
I think that's a really interesting point. And I suppose I should probably, like, I preface it by saying I'm actually not entirely sure. but, you know, like, one of the texts that this is often, I suppose, considered alongside, and it's certainly a big, certainly was very influenced by it, is Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. There are very clear echoes of A Portrait in this book, not least with its post-Parnellite setting and so on, the influence of the church, the influence of education, rebellion, the rebellion against of a youth, against everything, against the parents. All of, you know, these are quintessential Joycean kind of tropes, of course. But there's a sense that I think one could easily say that one of the things O'Fallon's doing is he's kind of doing for Cork, in a sense, what Joyce does for Dublin. Now, I don't know if he quite does that, but that may be a kind way, again, to read it. I'm not sure. But, like, I love the Cork references, too. You know, one of the things I fell in love with when I read this book first, and I still think it's truly masterful, was the idea of the grander, the grandfather, reading bizarrely the story of Faust to his grandchildren as bedtime story reading. And the way in which that story is told, the way in which the grandfather tells the story is wonderful, because he relocates it to Cork. And he relocates, he has the devil saying things like, me bucko, you know, and it's glorious. And he actually tells us that Faust lived under the bell tower, under the fish, you know,
in Shandon.
Yeah. And it's just like, he must have had so much fun coming up with that as an idea.
I mean, it is so extraordinarily Cork that I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was close to McInerney's recent books. That's what it reminded me of.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So, like, I haven't read anything that Cork since I read her work. So it is just so interesting. And I did think of Joyce as well, as in, you know, but how successful Joyce has been in constructing Dublin, and how utterly unsuccessful Bird Alone has been in making an impression on our vision of Cork. Even though I think it is, its description of, it's around Elizabeth Fort and all of the darkness of the houses, and then the beautiful Lee fields with the expansive river valley. I mean, it should it should be well read in Cork and become part of our streetscape. But maybe the man himself just made so many enemies, no one wanted to integrate him into us.
Yeah, he's certainly an abrasive figure, I think would be fair to say. I think he was difficult, you know. Maybe that would be the polite way to put it. Like, I think there, you know, he does extraordinary things, but I think he also made a lot of enemies. It was funny, actually. I as an aside, I give you an example of this. As a young man, he's cutting his teeth in the late 20s, and he's reviewing quite a bit. And George Russell, who was a very important mentor of his, forwarded him a copy of part of what was Work in Progress, what would become Finnegan's Wake. And O'Faolain reviews it for the Irish Statesman and writes a damning review, really damning review. Now, O'Faolain really admires the younger Joyce, and he'll talk about this later in the course of his life. He really admires, he doesn't like the more experimental Joyce. And that's partly to do with his own aesthetic preferences, you know, for certain types of realism and so on. But he goes on, he got into a bit of a spat then with one of Joyce's publishers and so on. But, you know, one can't but think that it was partly O'Faolain trying to make a name for himself. Like, he was very good at self-promotion, extremely good at that, you know. But bizarrely, when he publishes Bird Alone, he sent a copy of it to Joyce to see if Joyce would be interested in reviewing it.
Good Lord.
It's like, as if Joyce would have forgotten that this young pup had said this about Work in Progress. You know, it's just, it's bizarre. It's so funny. Now, like, we know, of course, that at this stage, Joyce was reading very little by the late 30s. His eyesight was exceptionally poor. Some of the, a lot of work was being read to him and so on. But he does he will read or have read in part to him just a couple of years later, Flann O'Brien's A Swim to Birds, you know, as one of the last texts that Joyce will publicly comment on in that way, or in a letter anyway. But yeah, for some reason, O'Faolain assumed that Joyce would want to read it. But no.
He had no shortage of, you know, self-regard, Sean O'Faolain.
No, he didn't. I think that would be fair. I think, though, you know, in fairness to him, there's a sense that he's self-fashioned. I think he's self-made. Mm. And I think he's growing up in a time and in an environment which is extraordinarily tough for him to do. You know, he's growing up in an environment, quite simply, where writers aren't trusted in Ireland. Mm. Do you know? He's unusual of his generation as a writer who stays in Ireland. Like, most leave. Most leave because of censorship or because of opportunities, or, you know, just because of how stifling this country is. O'Faolain was away. He was in North America studying. And then he moved back and he was in England for a couple of years teaching in the late 20s, very early 30s, before he actually makes the decision with his wife Eileen to come back to Ireland. So they actually go reverse to the trend of many people. And I think for him to do that, I suppose you'd almost have to have a big self-regard. You'd almost have to be that mentally tough.
Yeah.
Because, like, I think the kinds of pressures that writers were under, artists were under in Ireland at that time, I think it'd be hard for us to fully appreciate them now.
Yeah, I think it does demand a certain sort of personality to not only to continue to write, but to campaign against censorship and, you know, to be a minor public figure in that sense and still try and create art in the context of an extremely repressive society.
I think that's very true. It's funny, like, O'Faolain soon after this, like in 19, this Bird Alone is published in 1936, as you say, and the following year he'll publish one of his finest collections of short stories, his second collection, A Purse of Coppers, which is really very, very good. Now, O'Faolain will find himself drifting more and more and more into essay writing, Now he'll publish a third novel, which is a disaster in 1940. He's not very good at some novels, but he'll actually really over the next decade, for the best part, really become almost completely absorbed in essay writing and in kind of public debates. And he'll get himself, through the course of his early 40s, more and more entangled in these, primarily through his editorship of The Bell, founding The Bell, which is such a hugely important cultural journal. And he uses The Bell for a number of things, one of which really is a vanguard in the fight against censorship. But by the mid to late 40s, he'll actually be exhausted by that.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, he finds himself, he actually has to step back in order to begin writing creatively again. That's so much of his energies. So I think that sense of, that difficulty of being invested in these kinds of debates, but actually trying in some way to juggle that with being a creative writer in a climate which really distrusts creative writing, and especially Irish creative writers, is very, very difficult for him.
Yeah, he worked hard. He really did, you know. I don't know how he managed it.
No, he really is a towering figure. He is a huge, and he's a hugely important influence then on the next couple of generations. Do you know, either writers that he'll nurture, but also writers then in turn who'll kick against him, you know, which is an important thing too. So there's that generations will come up and he will be that totemic figure that they will fight against and they will, you know, pitch their argument against. And I think he quite enjoys that too, that kind of sense of grandeur, do you know, which comes later in his life. I suspect he did anyway. Personally, I think one of the things he's doing in this novel, I certainly think there's an element of a writer who has long left his native city, but who is kind of imaginatively reconstructing it. And I kind of see it in part as kind of, you know, it's almost kind of like a love letter to Cork. Do you know, there's something quite loving about the city, you know, for all of his slagging it off. A little like his great contemporary and friend, Frank O'Connor, you know, there's a very strong sense that their associations with Cork are complex, but they are really enduring. They have a very enduring love of the city, I think.
Yes, much like their, you know, the issues around faith. It's what you learn when you are young, and that it's hard to ever really shake it off.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as a result, it will be the Cork of the turn of the century, do you know, because that's the Cork that they grew up with. That's the Cork of Foilon will remember is the Cork of the tens and the 1900s through to the early 20s. That's really his time before he begins to move to Dublin. Can I ask, one of the things you mentioned, or just earlier, should say, was that you mentioned how, as you were reading this, you thought of The Young Offenders.
Yes.
And I was intrigued by that as a fan of The Young Offenders. I was thinking, I'd say O'Fuelan would have loved that, loved their side reference. I'm not sure you would have known what to make of it, but I'd say you would have loved it. How did you see that, just as a Corkonian?
I suppose I just felt that I could see Corny in that mode. Now, I know he's not part of a double act like the lads in The Young Offenders.
Indeed.
But he feels like, you know, he feels like a bit of a wide boy, and he's kind of like, he's trying to be cool, and he's young and he's hip and he's trendy and, you know, very self-consciously. And the whole relationship with, you know, a woman outside of marriage and all of the family conflict that brings in. I mean, The Young Offenders obviously doesn't have all of that Catholic guilt stuff going on because times have changed. But I felt that it is that star-crossed lovers, the eternal story, and the young people, and the immersive Corkness of the text, really so self-conscious, so clearly articulated and reinforced. And I just, that's what it reminded me of, The Young Offenders, you know, the young fellas, and so Cork.
Yeah, no, I when you said it, I was thinking a lot, and I was thinking, gosh, that's such a good description of it as well, because there's that lovely sense of, you know, the way in the young Offenders, they're always on the move, you know, they're always mapping out their space, you know, and they're actually kind of claiming that space for themselves. And because I think that is really one of the things clearly O'Fuelan's trying to do in this text. Like, he is trying to claim Cork. And I think that this is, if you will, just in a slightly broader cultural field, this is what he wants Irish writers to do with The Bell in 1940, but it's what he and Frank O'Connor and a number of his contemporaries are really trying to do post-revival, post-independence, is trying to encourage people to write about small parishes in Ireland. You know, it's Patrick Kavanagh will do it, you know, with Monaghan. That sense of trying to write about areas you know, Kate O'Brien will do about Limerick, you know, areas you know that are yours, and trying to kind of claim them through art, claim them through literature. And I think that that is really something he is actually also trying to do. So that it, you know, if you will, it's almost, I'm hesitating not to say post-colonial, but there is a kind of, there is certainly kind of an attempt to write back against other representations of the city and other representations from without. And rather, like, this is the voice of a Corkman writing about the Cork he knows and loves and mapping it out in text in a, at times a local idiom. So you can see how I just, the links with something like Young Offenders, where it can enjoy and celebrate that idiom, do you know, is it just seems to me there's almost, there's a lovely trajectory there.
Yeah, and you're right about movement. I mean, in the Young Offenders, they're always moving, you know, they're always walking, driving, cycling. And Corney spends his whole time walking. He's just walking constantly. There's this sense of he has to go from one part of the city to the Lee Fields, then he goes back. And that epic day with Elsie, I think they must travel miles and miles.
Oh, God, yeah, they never stop. Absolutely. But they do. Everyone seems to be always walking. And I suppose it's partly because they've nowhere to go. And it is that sense, isn't it, that, you know, often, like, you know, the youth take to the roads, you know, like people, given out during lockdown, that you've seen the youth out walking about, it's because, well, they've nowhere to go. Do you know what I mean? That older folk can stay in, you know, but in order to have some space, they actually have to claim that outdoor space. But it is, I like, there's that sense of of movement, which is so important. And I just think for O'Fuaylán, it's linked to an act of claiming, of kind of claiming that space for art, for writing, and to claim it seriously, you know, so that, you know, it's effectively saying, look, Cork is the site for a modern tragedy. And that is it in this text.
I don't see why it isn't on sale in every shop here in this city, because it seems like exactly the sort of book that people would go for. So it's, yeah, I mean, he's surely due a revival in Cork, at least.
He certainly is. He certainly is. I think you're right.
So can we play censorship bingo, which is, of course, the part that everybody likes. I mean, as far as I can tell, it's a really low score already. That's just my thoughts.
No, I think it'll be low.
I think it's going to be low. The first one is, as usual, breasts. No.
No, although there's a lovely, lovely criticism of O'Fuaylán. It was brilliant by a writer I deeply, deeply admire, who's just actually published a collection of short stories again, Evelyn Conlon. And Evelyn Conlon wrote a wonderful essay. It was a review, the Cork Review, actually, in 1991 to commemorate his death. The late Sean Dunn edited a special issue of the Cork Review. And he got a lot of people to say how wonderful O'Fuaylán was. Everyone was going, how wonderful he was. And Evelyn Conlon, as she didn't toe the party line. She said he was good in part, but, and she described him as a writer for whom the breast always looms large. So there you go. So maybe it does.
Somewhere there in the kind of meta-narrative space rather than...
Maybe on the meta-narrative. I think it's always, mothers always have large bosoms in O'Fuaylán's work.
Oh, that's true.
It's true. Yeah, yeah, they do. Yeah. Which probably will tell you a lot, but I've no idea. But no, in terms of bingo, I think no. Evelyn Conlon, notwithstanding.
Not in a sexual context. Mammy, leaving Mammy aside.
Leaving Mammy, yes, it is that kind of book.
And the next one is bestiality, definitely not.
Oh, God, no. Although sex is equated with the devil. So it's probably the ultimate form of bestiality. It really depends on how you're reading it.
Oh, God. Yeah, you see, you can, I mean, if you want to be like the real censor crazy
absolutely.
Catholics, you can take offense at everything.
Absolutely. I'll play that card.
sex work. Well, yeah, they do mention whores.
There is the actress thing in London. And I think, you know, there is the thing as well, isn't there, that his mother had a voice. It's very interesting. His mum had a voice and then she stopped. But that relationship between the mother and the sister, it isn't explicitly, yeah. So like, yeah, no, we don't really go onto the streets. So I think I'm reading between the lines here.
His mother's sister is Virginia, isn't it? And she lives in London. And then she comes to stay with them. And I was convinced from reading it that the sort of subtext was that she was a prostitute or, you know, some sort of
sex worker,
courtesan or something. And then I reread it to look for the reference and I couldn't find it. So.
No. Okay. Well, I'm glad you read it that way because I did too. I did too. It was much to do with her glamour and her...
Yes, a kind of suggestion of ease and luxury. But how did she get the money?
Yeah.
I think we could take it for her because there's something there, even if it's really impossible to, you know, like point at a line.
I think it might encourage other readers to find those points.
That's true. Yeah, right. If you can find the sex work, call
us. If you can find it, we'll get the book republished.
Racism, no.
No, although I do think it's not racism, but anti-Semitism. I think that one could very easily read that very wonderful comic kind of encounter with the local rabbi as also deeply offensive. So I don't know if I'd call it racist, but...
Yeah, you see, you could see if that was being, say, played on screen, how it could go terribly wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you'd play it. Yeah, and that's one of the better moments, so you'd have to. Okay.
Okay, we can take that one then.
Okay.
Drugs, no. These isn't even drink.
No, it's not that kind of book.
Not that kind of book. Politics. Well, yes, all the Fenianism and Redmond.
Politics. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, left, right and centre. Yeah.
I do think that is what you were saying. It's trying to interrogate ideas about republicanism and nationalism, but using older terms that are less contentious, I think.
I think so. And like, again, one of the clearest moments in which O'Fallon nods to Joyce is when he effectively replays that very famous scene from early in A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, where there's the discussion about Parnell and what happened to Parnell and how Parnell was pulled down by the church and how we as a people betrayed him.
Yeah, I mean, we have to take politics for definite. And the next one is swearing. I think it doesn't have the coarse language that it could, given the idiom it's set in, that's been kind of deleted.
I think it has. I think O'Fallon may be self-censored in that instance in order to try to get the book published.
The next one is infidelity. Well, no. Nobody who's married is carrying on, are they?
No, I don't think... No, no, no.
Crime. Well, yes, the attempted suicide is definitely criminal.
It is in its first time, absolutely. Yeah, that would probably be closest, I think. Yeah,
I think so, yeah.
I'm not really comfortable including that, though. And I think they would, you know, it would be seen as a, it would be described, it would be, you know, kind of talked about in another way.
Yes, as more immoral rather than a criminal act.
Yes.
Okay, so the next one is genitalia. Well, no.
No.
Surely not. Did I miss?
No, gosh.
No. Abortion. No, when she gets pregnant, they don't talk about that at all. So the next one is orgies. No, definitely not.
God, no.
No.
I'm intrigued by the list.
But you see, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
Sexual assault. I don't think so, even though he does kind of press Elsie.
Yeah. I have a kind of a theory about this, I must admit, and I can share it with you.
Please do.
I find the scene early on in this text, I find it extraordinary, the scene where Corny is remembering himself as a child, because it's all a memory narrative, and he's remembering his grandfather reading the story of Faust to him as a child. And there's a lot of intimacy in that scene as it's briefly described, and there's an incredible shift. There's a very brief and subtle shift by O'Fallon between the present and the past tense, And it's very, 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 it's very abrupt. It's very short and it's completely unglossed. And as a reader, you know, like, I don't think O'Fallon does these things lightly, because I think he's a very fine writer. And I can't help but, maybe because I read it the first time and this is what I thought, and ever since I kind of never seen anything else through, but through that lens, I think there is something about the grandfather kind of almost molding Corny in a way in which Corny in turn is trying to mold Elsie. And there is the sense of something of the relationship between knowledge and sex and abuse. I think in this text, I think there's almost something predatory at times about the grandfather in relation to Corny. I'm not saying he's a, you know, abusing his grandson, but there's something which is
there,
just...
You see, that's interesting, because when I was going through the book again today, I had that page marked.
Yeah.
And I looked and I was like, why did I mark that page? Because I hadn't written anything.
Sure.
And I was like, I don't know why I did, but there was something there that caught my eye.
It's very sinister. It's just, and it's so subtly done. It's so subtly done. And there is the sense that the grandfather is grooming, I think, is grooming Corny to be a certain type of person. He's not grooming him sexually, but he's grooming him to be almost this rebel. But there are sexual overtones to it, because rebellion is associated with sex in this text.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, it's not sexual assault in the sense that it's an obvious act of sexual assault, you know, for any stretch.
I think the connotations, there's something uneasy going on there that kind of just flickers through. And
I think it's something like that that makes me also, it reminds me also as well that this is a writer who will become one of the great short story writers from Ireland of the last century, you know, because he is a writer who is exceptionally good at suggestion.
But I think for the purposes of bingo, we can't really tick it.
I think we should, because he hasn't got many votes so far. Otherwise, I fear he's going to be last.
And we're going to game the system, are we? Grand.
I think we should, 100%.
The next one is extramarital pregnancy, which whole plot.
I was going to say.
So, yes. Masturbation, no. No way, surely not.
No,
not even,
but
by
he spends a lot of time on the leafy banks of the Lee.
He does spend a lot of time on his own mooning around, yes.
He does, but...
Innocently, I think, in this case. Not even inference.
No doubt. Reading romantic poetry.
Thinking deep thoughts. Mm. Well, there's definitely no sex toys in it anyway, for sure. We can scratch that.
No, there are a lot of rosary beads, but...
Oh! Now, that's a blasphemous thought if ever there was one.
It is.
Feminism. I would have to say no.
I would have to agree.
I mean, there should be by this stage, but...
I would agree.
So, yeah, we can't tick feminism then.
No, I wouldn't tick
the opposite. Anti-feminism.
Yes, anti-feminism. Probably quite close to misogyny, which other people have claimed over it once.
Yeah, I mean, the female characters in the book are not great. The next one is divorce. Definitely not. No one's divorced.
No, wouldn't you heard? Yeah, yeah.
And there's no contraception, obviously, because...
No, well, Elsie gets pregnant.
Elsie gets pregnant and they seem to have no idea that this was going to happen, which is the scary part.
It is. Well, again, it's the idea of being thrown out naked to the wolf of life. They actually don't know. You don't know.
They just don't have a clue. And there is an interesting reference, though, where Elsie's father, when Corny goes to sort of ask permission to marry her, he more or less says, you know, like that he wore his wife out with children and that she died young. And he sort of says, I wish I'd never married her because it killed her. And it's this astonishing admission that, you know, this marriage system that we have of continuous reproduction and marrying young sucks. But I don't think we can tick it nonetheless, because any contraception.
If there's another box, we should tick the other box. Yes.
Yeah. Well, there certainly isn't any menstruation anyway, if we can be absolutely sure.
Not that we know of.
No, he doesn't mention that. But blasphemy. We really, yes. I mean, the politics aspects around the Fenians definitely touch on church-state politics.
Absolutely. And the story of Faust is central to this book. The various myths of the story of Faust and of the of the rebel who sells his soul for a moment's paradise, for a moment's pleasure. Like, that is so important. It's the story of Faust is associated with the grandeur earlier on in the text. It's repeatedly associated with the story also of Corny. So I think, and like, that is surely one of the great blasphemous stories. You know, this person who overreaches God and who plays God because he sells his soul to the devil. So yes, I think blasphemy is good.
Definitely. I think the priest would not have liked so much of the book.
No. They banned it.
Yes. Oral sex? No, definitely not. Graphic violence? The violence that happens in the prison is kind of, it's not really graphic. It's more just
It's not,
lines.
But there's that figure as well. Is it Condorum? Is it the local kind of builder, and he's kind of, you know, he's very sinister. I think there is a lot of violence in this text.
That builder guy is really creepy. There's something odd about that. I think we could tick that one. Queer content? No, surely not. I didn't catch any echoes of anything.
No, I do still think the grandeur and the grandson in bed together, but I'll pass on that because it's really not where I want to go because I found it very uneasy.
Yeah, no. So if we count it up then, that's 5 out of 25 that we have to give to Bird Alone, which is pretty low.
It's pretty low. Is it the lowest so far?
No, it's. I don't think it's the lowest so far. I think someone did get 3 once. But it is the 1930s, and to be honest, they're banning books that by later standards are extremely mild and very genteel. Thank you so much, Paul. That was great. I've really thoroughly enjoyed trashing out Sean O'Fwayloin and Bird Alone. It's been wonderful.
Listen, it's been lovely talking to you, Aoife. It's been an absolute pleasure. And congratulations with the podcast series so far. And
thanks.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Next episode, I'll be swapping Cork for Berlin when I read Goodbye to Berlin by Christopher Isherwood. Famous for its decadent nightlife, will not be popular with the Irish censor. Censorship is fundamentally anti-fun, after all. But I love Berlin, so I cannot wait to read about it. Till then, keep your hands clean and your minds filthy.